Welcome back to the Dog Gone Wrong podcast, where myself and others share their mistakes and help you lift the guilt burden. I'm your host, Sarah Roper, the multi-dog maven.
Hello. Today I have the one and only Michelle Puglio with me all the way over the pond. For the true dog geeks listeners, I'm sure she won't need any introduction, but I'm going to introduce her anyway. Michelle worked for Guide Dogs for the Blind in America for 42 years. She's been responsible for bringing reward-based clicker training internationally to the guide dog field, and I'm sure to assistance dogs as well. She has travelled the world teaching other dog professionals, and I was lucky enough to see her a good few years back at Clicker Expo. And maybe, I can't remember whether it was PuppyCon or not, but I'm sure we'll come on to that. In her free time, she's competed in dog sports and horse sports. She's just told me before we've come on to record that she's just got two little American miniatures, horses now, but not in horse sports anymore, but concentrated on dog sports, which has been from obedience, agility, and then canine freestyle. With her show type Springer, I think that's where she started anyway, I'm sure she'll correct me if I'm wrong, and went on to win 4 international competitions, titled 5 dogs as champions. But anyway, before I fangirl anymore, let's welcome Michelle. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Sarah?
I'm good. I have been very excited about doing this. I will try not to fangirl too much, I'm sorry. I'll apologise in advance. Would you like to tell the listeners about your current dogs and, you know, what you're doing with them and things like that, please?
Currently, I have 2 young dogs. The last year has been kind of difficult. I lost 2 dogs within a year, one to lung cancer, Saki. And then I had an old Springer that hung around for 14 years. She did well, but we lost her in the same year.
Sorry.
So, yeah, it was kind of tough. So it actually ended up getting me a new Australian Shepherd from my breeder. And he's just a kick. He's like a year and a half now. And my young Springer, I call her young, now she's 5. So the young Aussie Indy is obviously getting all the foundation type of training. And I hope to maybe show him in freestyle this spring at the entry level. And then Keiko just got her grand championship in musical freestyle just a little bit ago, like a couple of weeks ago.
Well done. Congratulations.
Yeah. Which is really a cool thing for her. She's a COVID puppy and she did not get enough socialization. She's very sensitive. So it doesn't take much for her during a performance to get a little bothered if there's something going on in the environment. And then she isn't able to really output her best parts, but she's really athletic and she's a gorgeous girl. They're both very fun. Indy, the young man, is going through puberty right now and he believes he's the stallion of the of the West. But he's a sweetheart and he's a comic. He's a comedian. He's always making us laugh, which is something we all need nowadays.
Definitely.
Exactly. So every day he does something just so ridiculously funny and it's like intentional. So I've never had a dog that like intentionally tried to like make you laugh. So he's really fun. And then she's the sweetheart, you know, the cuddler and all that.
Okay, cool. So as this podcast is all about kind of mistakes or, you know, learning points, the journey that you've been on, would you like to take us through a couple of mistakes that you've made with dogs in the past?
Boy, you know, when you say mistakes, because I had so many years, 1970, I started training, obviously traditional. And I was very lucky to have good people teaching me. So, you know, I look at myself even early on as a good traditional trainer, but as the years went by, not wanting to be so harsh, you know, wanting to move away from the rock'em sock'em type of jerk release stuff. But I'm drawn more, when you ask me that, to that period of time, because it's so interesting how you look up to the people who teach you something and have experience, and that also means you trust them. So you put your trust in this person who tells you to jerk harder, you know, on the dog. And for some reason, you don't even think about the fact of, could there be another way, you know, to do that? Because this person's successful, they've done it for a long time. And I kind of feel like Ken Ramirez does about back when he was doing work with marine animals using positive reinforcement. And then when he went to the dog community to volunteer for a guide dog school, he was told, this is how you have to do it. And it's so interesting how even Ken Ramirez back then said, I guess with dogs, you have to do it this way.
Right? We have to show them who's boss, yeah, obviously.
Exactly. It's like with dogs. This is how you train dogs. And here he was already using positive reinforcement. And it took him a long time to go, wait a minute. But for me, it was a very long journey in traditional training. And unfortunately, a lot of the people I was around in the 1970s were extremely harsh traditional trainers. And it tapped into my questioning of, I don't want to have to do that. Is there a better way to do it? And so all through the 90s and the 90s, I worked really hard to improve our training program at Guide Dogs and improve my own training. It still was traditional training, but it was a lot nicer traditional training. And it really focused on quality praise, relationship, you know, touch, voice, whatever the dog would respond to. No food at all. A little bit of playing, interacting playing, not using implements, you know, like a toy or something like that. But every time I was around one of these trainers in the 70s and the 80s especially, and I'm watching them train dogs and get the job done very harshly, kind of look at those as moments where I knew that's a mistake. Being able to watch it in your face is like, I didn't have to do it, is what I'm saying. You know, it's like,
It's different. Yeah.
Watching it was recognizing that just isn't, it's just not right. You know, not even using words like ethical and stuff like that. Just, I mean, back then, you never heard the word ethical, but just the questioning of that is wrong. And so when I would come upon a challenge, it would enter my mind to try that technique I saw, right? It would like make me go, oh, maybe I should do what he did when that happened. And then I would catch myself as I'm doing it and realizing that it's a mistake. Hold on, let me turn my phone on. So your question draws me back to the old days of mistakes to me were really blatantly just unfair training to the dog. And I'm not teaching, right? I almost didn't like the word training anymore because that's what, of course, we were called. We're trainers. I like the idea of calling it, can I teach this animal something? Can I do something that way? So in traditional training, there's way too many things that, you know, you could just pile up a list of, yeah, don't do that anymore. Never do that again. That didn't work, right? Those experiences were a lot more numerous and I would say blatant. But interestingly enough, when I started with positive reinforcement training in around 2000, I was so excited about this tool and the fact that I was seeing this animal actually learn something, not kind of being coerced, forced into doing something. But I'm remembering a mistake very clearly. I had no experience with negative punishment. As a traditional trainer, you don't. There's no way to have experience with it because you don't have something the animal has been enjoying to withhold,
no,
to punish them, right? And so I'd heard all about, you know, removing reinforcement when the animal isn't working well or something like that. I'd never even considered doing it. I didn't really know how to do it. I mean, I wasn't like seeing instances where, oh, I guess I could use that negative punishment thing. And one day I was training my young Aussie, Listo, who became a really spectacular performer. And he was doing this behavior of backing up and he had a long distance back away. And he was just doing it really slow. There was like not a real spark to it that moment, right? And so all of a sudden I got this idea in my head, let me try negative punishment. And so I walked over to him and escorted him with my finger through the collar and put him in a crate. And I got my other dog out and I played with it a second. And then I put that dog up and I got him back out. And oh my God. Oh my God. It was like he was going backwards at 90 miles an hour. And I thought, I've discovered the method.
This is the answer to all your problems.
Magic, you know, right? Wow, negative punishment. How cool is that? What I didn't stop to think about is, It's very powerful. So be very careful. And I made a huge mistake with it with that same dog. It was two times in his whole career I applied negative punishment. That one, which of course worked out really nice for the moment. And the next one I did, negative punishment, was when he didn't listen to me when I called him. We have a long driveway. And when cars start coming up that drive, we didn't used to have a gate down there. It's very worrisome about the dog's safety, right? Yeah. So it's, you know, the whole recall thing in the driveway area is always important. He was like, you know, 8 years old or something, you know, he knows how to recall. And when I called him, he didn't come. And of course, then I'm freaking out about a car coming up the driveway. So I'm running and I grabbed him and grabbed the collar and pulled him off to the side. And I was just so mad, but I just kind of like acted like he wasn't there. He started screaming. You would think I was hitting him or something like that. Emotionally, it just crushed him. It was like I had no idea that removing my attention could have that sort of impact. But he was also reading into how upset I was at the same time, because worrisome.
Well, they do, don't they? Yep.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So my adrenaline was really high. His adrenaline was high because the reason he didn't come is he was barking at the car, right? So his adrenaline was up too. And I thought I was catching myself, preventing myself from doing something traditional by like jerking on him or something like that. I just removed him off to the side. And then I decided I would ignore him for a few seconds, right? Negative punishment, you know, take all your, I couldn't believe he started screaming. I mean, it's like, I looked down and I'm like, is something wrong? It was all emotional. He was just so upset. And I'd never even heard the dog peep like that before. And boy, that was a big mistake. That day, I was totally accepting that negative punishment is something that is a tool, and it's a tool available to positive reinforcement trainers, because when you have a history of reinforcement, removing reinforcement can be very powerful. But be very careful about that power, because it really is powerful. And traditional trainers have a hard time understanding that because they've never had it as a tool. So, you know, they haven't had the ability to say, oh, I have this other thing that's available to me in my training. And so I've become a much more adept at using negative punishment when it's appropriate. And it's still a very powerful tool, but I have great respect for that power.
Yeah. It's not your go-to.
No, it is not. You know, to this day, Keiko, so she's 5 and a half. I think I've used it one time on her during a training session. And with her, because of her sensitivity, I mean, it was ridiculous. Anyone watching it would like, what are you doing? You know, because all I was doing was just turning my head away and just ignoring her. And of course, then she would walk around to the front and try to look at mom, and I would just turn my head the other way. And then after about 10 seconds, I went, okay, let's try that again. And they were like, what was that? I go, believe me, that affected her. And it did. But one time, it's the only time I can think with her I've even used in 5 and a half years of training. So I'm very aware that the more of a relationship and the history reinforcement I have with an animal, I have that other tool that I can use. So that's probably the most obvious mistake with positive reinforcement training that I've made. Now, day to day, I make mistakes all the time. I go, I could have done a better choice than that. You know, let me see. But not the kind of mistake that could affect the future in a negative way, right?
Yeah.
So to me, a big mistake really is something that hurts your relationship with the learner or hurts their ability to learn what you were trying to teach them, because now you've created a little bit of history about that behavior. Right. So it's like a lot of times when people come to me and they've got almost a poisoned behavior because they've had so much work they've been trying to do with this behavior and fix it and fix it and fix it. And I go, just let's start over with all new cues. You know, just let's start over, clean slate. And it goes so much better. It's just start over. Now, sometimes that's not easy to do with a clean slate because you have a lot of training cues that are similar when you're trying to start over to train a behavior. But you can really try to go, okay, let's make a list of what are the things that this dog is really used to seeing happen when we're training this behavior. We have to get those off the table. We have to like come at it from a whole new angle. But it works really well. And people are always amazed, but it's like he really doesn't know this behavior. I go, well, he doesn't. That's what you've been complaining about.
And quite often in those situations, I find that it's the energy from the handler, the owner, the trainer, you know, whoever is teaching this behavior. If they're getting frustrated and angry and like, just why can't you do this? The dog is more poisoned by that energy than anything else. So yeah, starting again.
Yeah, and you know, the other part of that, Sarah, is the handler who is upset that they're not doing well. So they put that on the dog too. So I can't tell you how many times I've caught somebody when I see they have this thing they do, and their thing is, darn. And, you know, something like that. And what they're doing is they're like trying to reprimand themselves that they forgot and they did it wrong. And I go, your dog just thinks you're upset now, right? You just punished your dog. It's like
you might not be trying to, but you are.
You have to learn how to do your self-correction, your emotional self-correction of your own work, your training, your moves, whatever you did, saying the wrong cue, whatever. You've got to do that internally. You know, you can't do it openly to the dog. You might be putting on a demonstration for other humans in the area, and those humans go, she knows she made that mistake. She's upset with herself. Well, but the poor dog.
No.
Poor dog is like learning that when I do a little bit of this behavior, she gets really upset, right? So why would I try to do it again? So many of the students that come to me for private lessons have that little weird edge on them that they haven't noticed, that they've got this thing they do out of habit. And the reason they do it is they don't have a lot of self-confidence, right, in their training. So it's kind of like a self-excuse. Well, that's just me. I did it again. I screwed up again. I'm like, you got to change that. You know, it's like your dog is a very forgiving animal. He's not going to kill you. If we were working lions, you might be in a real problem with that behavior you're doing.
I'm going to steal that. If you were training lions right now. Yeah, I've stolen that one. Thank you.
You know, if you're going to train a lion and go, damn, you know.
No, you're dead.
About that. Yeah. Or a grizzly bear, you know, you choose. Yeah. So I think one of the things that maybe a mistake I made is the very first dogs I got, I knew nothing about dogs. Wasn't able to have a dog at home. My mom didn't like dogs. As soon as I got on my own, I got my first dog. And it was a Labrador Retriever. And the only reason I got a lab was I had just seen the original Incredible Journey with Luau. I had to have one of those young ones, right? Okay, that might have been a big mistake. And the reason is a reason guide dog schools internationally use Labradors and Labrador crosses. There's a reason. They are the easiest dogs. They are so easy. I mean, now, because it's become such a popular breed, there's a lot of problems in some labs now, temperaments that never used to be there. I mean, unfortunately, you know, but as a well-bred animal, the Labrador is suited to be a guide dog. I mean, they're suited to it. Their resilience is amazing. You know, they have this happy-go-lucky attitude. You could accidentally step on his paw and he's going to scream, but he's going to come right back the next day and go, I still love you. I'm not reactive to you. The lady on the bus accidentally hits him in the head with her shopping bag as she gets on the bus, and he just forgives her. He's not going to eat her. He's not going to shy away from her, right? So, because I started out with Labradors, and that's what I did all my initial competitive obedience for 10 years with Labradors, I was spoiled. I mean, so all you guide dog trainers out there, If the only thing you've ever worked with is Goldens and Labs, you need to branch out and learn a little bit.
Yep.
If you truly want to get it to be a better trainer, train some difficult breeds and really get a feel for what it's like, because dogs in general spoil us. You know, it's not like training a porpoise, and it's not like training a giraffe. And, you know, dogs are amazingly forgiving in general. But when I got my first Springer, that dog taught me a lot. I made a lot of mistakes because even though I was a really good traditional Labrador trainer, I was not a good trainer for a more sensitive type of dog. And so my mistakes were mainly just using the exact same training for the Labradors as I was, you know, I just started, it's a dog. This is how I train it. Well, no, you have to adapt a bit to different individuals. And so the Springers really began to teach me how to read the individual dog. And even at work at guide dogs, I would always be given the real sensitive Labradors that people were having trouble with. They go, give it to Michelle. I love
she'll fix it.
Yeah, she'll fix it, you know. And I thought I was really good at that. And then the Springer told me, no, you're not really that good.
Where your confidence comes crashing to the ground.
Exactly. I went, yep.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in a way, it is interesting to run into so many really excellent guide dog trainers when, across the globe who have never trained anything but a Labrador. And so their skills are good with that particular dog, but it's not really like you could just walk out and take a sighthound and get it ready for competitive obedience. You know, you have to have a lot of other skills, but positive reinforcement makes it so much easier to obviously be successful with more difficult breeds. So I'm trying to think if there's any other mistakes that I can.
Well, just going back to what you were saying when you were watching the more traditional training, you know, in the early days. And then when you were working with dogs and when things happened, you, in your head, you were reverting to those more, you know, punitive methods, let's say. But at that point, all I was thinking of, well, because that's something that you've learned, you know, that particular way to deal with that issue, it's a tool in your training toolbox. But it's also the same, I'm making the point for the listeners, I know, well, I'm hoping you'll agree with me on this one, is it's also the same with the dogs. The dogs have a repertoire of behaviours or tricks or whatever you've taught them, or they've learnt, not necessarily what you've taught them, and they will always have those in, you can't unlearn what you know.
That's right.
You can only build up a reward system, well, ideally, you build up a reward system where the other behaviours are preferable rather than going to the negative or, you know, unwanted behaviors. I think obviously there are a lot of similarities between a human's learning journey as there is with a dog's.
Everybody has a learning journey for sure. I mean, it's to this day, after at least 25 years of being in the kennel complex running huge groups of dogs. So one person out there with 35 dogs. Right. And trying to break up little fights that are starting or something like that. Right. To this day, if two dogs are somewhere that I'm not watching and a little bit of a snarky fight starts or something, I mean, my adrenaline shoots up and what comes out of my mouth is usually, and it's, I can't get rid of that. I can stop it quickly, but it's there because of years of having to react and only having the tool of intimidation to stop something, right?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it still rears its head. You know, it's
I get it though, because at some point, like you found at some point, you found many years ago that that particular worked for one opportunity, let's say. So you carry on practicing it because at that moment you're panicking that the dog's going to hurt each other. They might hurt you. They might hurt other dogs. You know, they might get really injured. So you go to a behavior that has worked in that moment. And it's how your amygdala reacts at that moment because it's trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a fan of Dr. Phil's phase. How's that working for you? Yeah. I mean, obviously, one of the reasons that it keeps repeating is that it works, right? But it's one of those things that is always there reminding me, yeah, it's still there. There's still a traditional trainer on my back that I can't get rid of, right? So it's a conscious effort to change those things that are almost on autopilot, which they were for quite a while. You know, when I first started learning positive reinforcement, I remember thinking, oh, this is really good for tricks.
Only for tricks.
It's really good for tricks, right? Because how else would I have taught a dog that without the food? It's like, well, duh, Michelle, put two and two together and realize that's it's all behavior, right? Yeah, so that's something that I think positive reinforcement trainers who haven't had a history of traditional training can be extremely critical of crossover trainers. And they don't understand that, you know, that isn't that the person is necessarily choosing to, in that moment, do something that for years they already did. And it's like a pattern. They also might not have the progression at a level of wanting to change that, right? So to them, they're accepting that, well, I'm a balance trainer. They think of themselves that way. And you know, that's the individual. But just the idea that if I walk into a big dog venue, you know, I'm walking into a big seminar or something that's starting and I'm bringing my dogs in, I always warn everyone, you're going to watch my dogs drag me in. My competitive dogs, I don't practice loose leash walking. Like, it's like they drag me everywhere. I said, just warn us, because if I wanted to make them behave themselves, it would take a lot of focus and repetition. And I just want the dog feeling great when he walks in there. So I want him wanting to pull me in there. The same as for my sport dog. When I open the crate, I want him jumping out of the, yay, here I am, I'm ready. Whereas for more practical day-to-day dog training and like a dog that is easier for people to handle, having the dog wait when you open the door and all, it's a very useful tool. Just for me and my sport dogs, it's like, I don't want them even having to worry about that. I want them wanting to come out. Do I want them screaming and pawing at the crate? No, can't have that.
There are rules, yes.
Exactly. But the idea that when I actually open it, I'm also saying okay, and they bound out because they're ready to work. So I just like that. Then I know if they don't bound out, what's wrong? So that also gives me an assessment tool of how ready is this dog to work. And if the dog lays down the crate and looks at me, I'll probably just say okay and just close the crate again. Say, you want to stay in there? That's fine. If I coax them out, I'm probably going to rub them up and just put them back in. With cookie, you know, something like that. But it's
I think, sorry.
No, go ahead.
What you're saying there about your dogs like dragging you into venues and you're wanting them to work and, you know, but like bursting out of crates. I say that, but you know, I know it's with an okay, and you want that energy because that's your priority with them. Not only is it relationship, it, you know, it's you want to go and do these exciting things with the dogs where high energy is key. Because that's freestyle, isn't it? You know, you need that energy to keep it going. You want that drive. And that's your priority. And that's what you want to put the time and energy in. So your priority isn't to spend the time walking them on a loose lead. And it's not rewarding to you. So you're not going to put the time and energy in. But I think for people with pet dogs, for example, that, you know, they are more likely, their priority is an easily manageable dog. So putting the work in for loose lead walking, that's their priority. That's where their time and energy is going to go. None of it is wrong because it's what you perceive as what you want in a dog. And having that relationship with them.
Yeah, as long as you're being fair and consistent, there's nothing wrong. It's like, what do you want? So I live on 9 acres. I don't have to take my dogs for walks. And if at some point in my life I'm in a living situation like that, I don't know what I'm going to do. Because it's like I'm so spoiled that I can turn my dogs out my front door and we have like a park right there, you know. So I don't have to teach loose leash walking. If I had to take my dogs for a walk every day, on sidewalks, right?
It might be more important.
would have to focus on more control. It's simply, now, comically, my dogs might look that coming out of crates for training. In my house, we have rules about when I open a door, right? They don't go crash outdoors. They wait at the door till I tell them to go ahead and go out the door. And that isn't even having much to do with safety here in my living situation, because I'm turning them out to a fenced backyard, right? It's practice. It's practice at controlling your energy and then going, right? So it's a way of being kind of safe and polite to the other dog that's trying to also go through the door.
Yeah.
A little bit safe for me. I don't get knocked over by a crazed male Aussie trying to get out the door. So the fact that I can open a door and the door itself is the cue, I don't have to say anything. It's like I just crack the door and they go, oh, that's right. And they wait and I open it and go, okay, go, you know, and they run. So it's like the control aspect of living with a dog is all about your individual situation and what your needs are. It's as simple as that. But being consistent is really important. Oh, yeah.
Definitely. And I think especially when you have multiple dogs, you know, the barging through the door when they're all going through, we all know that that's a hot spot. If you're ever going to have any problems between your dogs, it's going to be that kind of thing. Food, when you walk back in the door because you're fun, you're who they want to be with, and everyone gets overexcited, or if it's overexcited going through doorways to go outside or whatever it may be, they're all like the hot points of if any of them are going to have a little scrap, they're the points that's going to happen. So putting a bit of manners, like, practicing that, you know what, you don't get to dash through here, is just what you do with multiple dogs. It's good practice.
Right. I took it so far one time with some young dog that the dog wouldn't go through the door. The dog just kept looking for the reward because I was obviously feeding for him waiting, right? So after a few moments, and it was so funny, it was to where I had to actually give him a treat so he would go out the door.
Bless. You've reinforced it so much. He's like, I'm not moving.
I created that. So the reinforcement I was giving him was obviously more powerful than the enjoyment of going out the door. But since that time, I have ceased even using food to train that, because their reinforcement is going out the door. I've got reinforcement. So it's right there and it's convenient. And that's what you want them thinking about, is if I do this, I get to go out the door. That's a lot more powerful training than if I don't go out the door, I'll get food, because they still want to go out the door.
Yeah. And at some point, if you give them enough treats, they will need to go outside that door. So have you got, is anything else coming to mind, kind of mistakes or, you know, learning points?
I think most of the mistakes I can think of for my dog sport have to do with me. Comically, this is way back in probably 2007 or 2008 with Lee Stowe, and I had a great routine to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And I went into the ring and got probably about 30 seconds in and realized I didn't bring my prop in. So the routine was like a struggle for the gold between Lee Stowe and I. And so I had these two gold bags over my shoulder, right, hanging. And so at the beginning, it's amazing to me that I didn't notice before I started, because I always had my hand up on my shoulder on the rope, you know, for the opening. And I realized when watching the video that it was kind of fascinating that I didn't have my hand up, and that didn't actually make me go, something's missing. Anyway, it was quite funny because it was going really well. And when I realized it, the part was coming up that I had to have, you know, it's like I can't, there's no way to do the rest of the routine without it. And if I tried to make up a routine, you know, Lisa would have thought I was crazy. Anyway, I just had to say, you know, went over to the judge and said, sorry, I'm going to have to NQ me. But they, you know, I went and got the prop and did the routine, but I felt like such an idiot. And then I redid that mistake 2 to 3 other times over the years. You know, you think you'd learn really, but I get so focused on the dog. Sometimes I don't do enough prep. So I'm better now at not forgetting to do prep.
Do you think that's partly nerves in that situation?
I think so. I think it's that the nerves of performance gets me to focus on something else. And then, you know, but what I actually do now during training, which I didn't used to do back then, is I practice the entrances separately, like a separate training sequence. So I can prepare the dog better for the start by doing that. And it also prepares me because I'm used to, this is exactly what I'm going to do before I go in the ring. I'm going to set props that have to be set ahead. And then before I walk in the ring, I've got to have, you know, so everything's in a certain order, consistent. And so I haven't made that mistake for quite a while, which is good. But I kind of got, everyone was teasing me because I kind of got famous for, hey, Michelle, you got your props.
No, but you kind of almost done like muscle memory, haven't you, really, of this is how we set up, we practice this often, so you don't have to think about it. So clever.
So I don't need to have a checklist anymore, which for a while I thought, I guess I better have a checklist, but you know, it's I'm just more aware in general of that issue. But you know, that's the kind of mistake that is kind of frustrating, because he was putting a great performance in up until the point I just had to say, well, we're gonna take a break and make sure he didn't think anything was wrong.
Yeah, because you've got to still make sure that he's happy, because he's not done anything wrong.
Yeah, and I see a lot of people unfortunately do that in my sport, meaning that something goes wrong and everything in their body during the performance tells everybody. If you didn't know their routine, you know something went wrong. Because in freestyle, you could ad-lib your way through and sometimes do a better performance than you'd planned. But yeah, it's the same when things go wrong like that. I go overboard to make sure the dog doesn't think that they did something that caused the stop. Because just stopping to perform, even if you don't say anything to the dog, is like rude. So if I just walked over to the judge and started talking to them, it's like you walking out of the room when we're having this talk.
Yeah, it's a little bit rude.
So, I mean, the dog is the most important part, in my mind, of our partnership. And so it's like, yeah, I can screw up. But if I screw up, I want to make sure that if it somehow affects them, because I just did the wrong thing, and he goes, I don't think that's the way the routine goes. I want to make sure that he realizes that I know, and he's fine. Everything's fine.
Yeah. I think it's one thing if you do something out of the norm or whatever, but as long as the dog feels like they're, and I think it's the same in any dog sport. I do rally, and it's, if the dog, without the dog, it wouldn't be a sport. So it's about them. It's about that relationship with them. And sometimes, you know, I've had dogs that I've took into a dog sport and I've realized, you know what, this is not for them. And they, you know, dogs don't ask to compete. They don't actually have a concept of what it means. We just need to make sure that they enjoy it. And if they enjoy it, great, we carry on. But the second that they're not enjoying it, then we shouldn't be continuing with them, because that is not fair on them.
Right. Yep, that's right.
Have you ever had a dog that you pulled out of a sport for anything like that?
No, but I did competitive obedience for 20 years, but that was before I discovered positive reinforcement training. So only my last dog, which was my first Springer for freestyle, he had his intermediate open obedience degree. So he kind of was a crossover for my obedience training. I think that I haven't ever pulled a dog out, but I certainly can imagine, because I have acquaintances in the sport who have gotten a dog for freestyle. And I mean, I've been the one telling them, no, I don't think so. Yeah, I think you don't want to do this. He doesn't want to do this. You know, he's not. And maybe he wants to do it in your house, which is great. You know, the other thing that's great is now that we have video competitions, so many since COVID now available.
Yeah.
Because so many people are realizing, oh, my dog does better on his home ground, right? And without an audience. So many people have the ability now with dog sports that offer video comps to go ahead and compete, and their animal is okay with it because it's where they train. But if in your normal training area, your dog doesn't enjoy doing what you're doing, then yeah, you don't really want to do that. My COVID puppy, Keiko, is hard for her to perform in front of an audience, but not to the extent that I feel I won't show her in front of an audience. But I'm very thoughtful about like Keiko coming up this spring. We have a big event, 25 years of our club. And I want to go ahead and compete her, but I have to be very careful because I just retired this routine, which she's really good at, and I'm starting a new one. And I think that would be too hard on her to do a new routine for an audience. It'll be a high level mm-hmm. routine. So I'm toying with just pulling out this one we just retired, just to take it to this event. Because if she goes into the ring doing that performance, she knows it so well that she won't feel, I don't think, as insecure.
Yeah. So you're setting her up for as much success as you can in what for her would be a challenging environment.
Exactly. So, you know, I think that she could have fun doing that routine down there, and then we'd still be performing instead of not performing at the big event.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Anything else before we wrap up?
I can't think of anything. Wow, we've been talking a long time.
Yeah, we have. It's good. It's good. Are you offering, are you doing any kind of challenges, any online stuff at the minute? You know, like what's going on at the minute? What do you want to kind of share with the listeners?
I think for me in the world right now, lowering the amount of work I do because of my husband's health. So his health is declining, and this year I've backed out of much travel. I am traveling to Clicker Expo in Chicago and taking a little bit of break from the caregiving thing to do mm-hmm. that. So that'll be a fun teaching thing. I do teach online, which is easier for me to do than mm-hmm. travel. But I'm trying to wind things down a little bit in general, and I'm enjoying working with the service and guide dog industry and helping them continue to improve and progress in their positive reinforcement skills. There's a challenge in those industries now, and that now that most of them have adopted some level of positive reinforcement training, The one area that continues to be challenging to all of them is the area of distraction and how to deal with that with positive reinforcement. And the biggest mistake they kind of make is they want to do 100% change right away. And the ones that are having trouble. So meaning you totally get rid of any collar correction, any sort of like preventative mm-hmm. physical thing that you do, you throw it out with the trash, and yet you are not yet a effective positive reinforcement trainer. So to be able to go to the point where there is no such thing as punishment is quite a big step when you're having to train a dog on a timeline mm-hmm. and give it to a client to use, and this is not a professional dog person who'll be handling it. It's a challenge.
Everything's a bit wishy-washy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard. And so, unfortunately, what can happen is then a program can go, oh, this positive reinforcement stuff doesn't work. We have to still use correction. So here's the part of that is so difficult. Okay, so punishment, does that really work? Because are you telling me that if I correct the dog, you'll never have to correct him again? We know that's not true. We know that even in good traditional training, ongoing collar corrections or whatever verbal corrections are needed. They're a necessity. The behavior doesn't go away. And in fact, you have to punish it every time it happens, whatever it is. Let's say it's distraction in general. So it's like all of a sudden I'm hearing negativity from some programs about positive reinforcement training in general. And I'm like, yeah, that's really interesting, because it isn't like traditional training was like you correct once and that's it.
And that was it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, with positive reinforcement training, do you have to continue to reinforce for that difficult behavior of choosing to ignore distraction? Yes, you do. But guess what? You don't have to do it every time. With punishment, you have to punish every time. Yep. I mean, you have to. That's the only way the punishment's going to somehow work for you. So it's an interesting time right now in the service and guide community, because for those that are frustrated and saying it doesn't work,
I haven't been doing it for long enough to get good enough at it.
Doing it long enough to be good at it and understand about the strength of the history. So unfortunately, their timetables, and that includes the school I worked for 42 years, their timetables make it too difficult. And the fact that you have volunteers raising the puppies. So we have puppies coming in at a year of age that have practiced something for a long time. And it's a very difficult scenario to figure out a volunteer program that you can try to get the most important pieces, a good foundation on the most important pieces to that program. So that, because you're not going to get many volunteers that are going to put a lot of time in training a whole bunch of great things, right? They want to raise because they want to raise this dog to be a service or guide dog, and they want it to be successful, but putting a whole bunch of work on them, they're not going to do it that well anyway. Right.
No, it's probably maybe 1% of the socializers are actually going to know what they're doing, put the work in.
Well, and even programs who are able to furnish the instruction, it probably won't be done that well. There'll be people who shine and do a really good job, but I sympathize with the difficulty of the timeline. So how many positive reinforcement trainers do you know that have like a 5 or 6 year old dog and they're still working on distraction?
That's everyone.
But again, if they were using traditional techniques, they would still be using punishment. You know, I've seen a lot of dogs go through guide dog training from puppy to finish, a lot, hundreds and hundreds. And even the sweetest, kindest Labrador still needs an occasional punishment. They were brought up that way. It was done. And with positive reinforcement training, I would say it's a different number of when they need a little bit of something. You know, it's basically so much better. And it's just kind of a little bit frustrating for me to see that the industries are some of the old, the people that are complaining are the ones that were traditional trainers, because they're comfortable with that.
It's good.
Yep. I know how to do that. It works for the moment. Yeah, it works for the moment. And the positive reinforcement works for the moment. So let's pretend for a second. Let's just pretend that the outcomes are pretty much the same. You have to use punishment this number of times and you have to use reinforcement this number of times. Well, which one would you rather do?
I'd rather have something that isn't taking the dog's head off. Thank you very much.
And ask the client, what would you rather do? Would you rather carry food on you and give your dog rewards for doing good stuff? Or would you rather not carry food and jerk on his neck throughout the day? Which one would you prefer? And nowadays, your totally undoggy person, they're going to say, I'd rather do the food. Because in general, the world has, well, most of the world has gotten kinder and gentler. They're trying to be, right? So it's a phase. And it's a phase I went through. I mean, I went through a phase of saying, you know, I think I'm going to be lucky to get, I don't like to use the word balanced, because to me that means 50-50. That's what that means.
I was
striving 75% positive reinforcement. You know, I was like, I got to get there. Well, I went past that really quickly. I mean, I think I'm like 95% positive reinforcement, but it takes time and it takes dedication when you have another tool that you're so good at using. And you know how to use it.
And you've got the history of rewards because it worked.
You've got a history And even though a lot of that history was not rewarding because it didn't work very well, you tried and you tried and you tried and you tried and you know. So anyway, that's probably the only soapbox thing I think I'd get on. I'm just disappointed to see some of the groups having people speak out like it was a mistake to go to positive reinforcement. I'm like, how can anyone who learns how to use it say it's a mistake when the dogs are learning their skills so quick? So let's just put the distraction thing in another category, even though it's a behavior. If you put that aside as a separate category, it's like, oh my God, you know, the relationship between the trainer and the dog, the relationship between the client and the dog. I mean, there's no comparison.
Worlds apart. Yeah.
And I, you know, I will certainly protect and back up what I did because at the time that's all I knew how to do, but I'm also not going to like try to go, well, that's better than it is now. No way. No way. There's just no comparison. The relationship I have with my own dogs now is so much better than the relationships. I wouldn't know that back then. You know,
you've got nothing to compare to.
I got nothing to compare to, and I love living with my dogs. But, you know, the way my dogs were handled by me back then didn't let their personality show. You know what I mean? So it's like the silly things that Indy the comic does now. He's doing those because he feels the freedom to be who he is. Is that within rules and parameters? Of course it is. But at the same time, he feels at the moment when he has that opportunity, he's going to do a headstand in front of us and make us laugh.
But it's freedom of expression, isn't it? He can be himself. He feels like he trusts you and the situation enough to be himself and express himself. And as people, we all want to be in a safe environment where we can express ourselves. So why shouldn't the dog? But yeah.
Exactly. Right. And so, and that's been an intriguing part of the journey for me that I never thought about. I just always thought, well, that was that dog's personality. That was, not so much. I probably never really met that full personality because I kind of molded into exactly what I thought a dog was supposed to be in the house and to be, and even going out to play. You know, everything had this little niche it was supposed to fit into. So, the individuality of each dog is so big to me now, and I see it quickly, whereas before it took me a while to realize, oh, that dog's just different. It's real, and that also helps you when you're working with the other species too, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to leave it here for the listeners, but I've really enjoyed this, and hopefully the listeners will too. And I will be back for the listeners next week.
Okay.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dog Gone Wrong podcast. If you could do me a quick favour, like or follow the pod, rate and leave a review, and maybe share with a dog-owning friend. Let's get the word out there and ensure there is less guilt around the mistakes. Thank you again, and we'll be back next week.